tinkling piano, like that one, in the next apartment. Stumbling words that told you what my heart meant. A fairground painted, painted swings. These foolish things remind me of you. You came, oh, you saw.
Another great big band show. Thank you, Andy Paul, for sitting in today. We'll have a new DJ coming in next Friday, just a recent graduate from TCM 189 class, and we're looking forward to welcoming him to our air staff here. My name is Jay Koronek. For the next hour, we're going to have our special public affairs show, local like no one else does it, the new WHFR Journal. Local news and alternative views here on WHFR.FM, station making waves. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Why is it new? Because it's not the same as last week, folks. Got to keep listening either live on Fridays from 1 to 2 o'clock or on our podcast. As soon as the show is done, you can go to WHFR.fm, you know, and just click on Listen Now to Journal, the journal. It's just called Journal there, but it's really the new WHFR Journal, of course. I'm joined in the studios today by my two news team colleagues, our news director, Dennis Reimars. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Jay. How are you?
Oh, fantastic today. What a fantastic day here. It's very exciting at the college, especially in our Student Center building where the WHFR broadcast studios are located. And Amy Powers is with us, our WHFR news reporter extraordinaire. And Amy, mic check time. So tell us about your life in 10 seconds.
I'll just say good afternoon.
and Jay and Dennis. It's awfully nice to be here on a sunny day.
Isn't it, though? Very, very invigorating out there because it's a little bit crisp. I think it's below 37 degrees, according to my car. My car beeps at me whenever it drops below 37 degrees.
It beeps at me every time I walk in front of it.
Well, that's different.
That's probably you.
Yeah, that's when you're trying to steal it. Yes.
Okay. Oh!
Hands off the paint
it's
there,
amazing
Dennis.
How it knows.
Okay. Well, let's get down to the news stories. Enough of this exciting chit-chat among our staff. We're looking at the Dearborn Heights Press and Guide from last Sunday, March 21st. Just going from left to right on page 1A, districts mirror better MEEP results. That's the Michigan Educational Assessment Program across the state. And that's both statewide and even locally. There have been some improvements, so that's the good news. And this is a state developed thing. These assessment tests. And I was interested in just part of this. We won't go into the details because there has been slight improvements. Although Dearborn is in the higher grades. I'm just going to generalize here, but in the higher grades tested. They're falling down a little bit on reading, even though they've made improvements, but reading scores are not as high as other places in the state. And sometimes that's because of our large number of relatively new immigrants or people that don't start out speaking English natively. Obviously, they have trouble with the reading test because they haven't been reading and writing English since birth, so they're at a slight disadvantage. But all the test scores are coming up. Now, I didn't know this, and this is this story from Jody Rampala at the Press and Guide is primarily based on a press release from the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Mike Flanagan, and we did talk to his PR rep, who probably wrote this story for Mike. And what I thought was interesting is that, again, our students locally did perform well on the test in reading and math grades 3 through 9, but they were a few points down below the state average in reading, as I said, and there have been improvements, so that's good. But if you go to page 12A, which is kind of curious, a couple stories start on the front page, and they end on the back of the paper, back of that edition.
I like when they do that.
Well, it's easier. You don't have to sort through the pages. You know, it just, well, if it's was on the front and continued.
It's more user-friendly.
Yeah, but there's a lot more detail on the back, folks, and you really should read about that. But I thought it was interesting that these tests are based on curriculum standards that they've had that were implemented in 2004, 2005, and the state curriculum guidelines that these tests are based on are called the Grade Level Content Expectations, GLCE. I can never remember what those things stand for, but the Grade Level Content Expectations are the standards that the MEEP tests are based on. And these standards, this was what stood out to me, have been recognized by independent reviewers across the nation, our nation, the United States of America, to be among the most rigorous standards in the whole country. So, and I thought we were just, you know, dummying up the test to get them to pass. So, I think we should have very rigorous standards. I'm all in favor of that. People should be encouraged to learn everything they possibly can. But again, for the average student, the test can't be too demanding, of course. But it's interesting to know that Michigan, and good for the state board and the legislature that helped support this, in 2004, 2005, these standards that are part of the MEEP are recognized by independent reviewers across the nation to be among the most rigorous standards in the country. So at least we're doing that well. Unfortunately, we're not graduating so many kids from high school. That's one of the worst rates in the country in terms of number of high school graduates. In some places, it's 70 to 80%. In Detroit, you're lucky to get 30 to 40% graduating from the high schools in Detroit, from the students that are in Detroit. So that's got to change. But nonetheless, those that stay there are taking tests and being expected to meet standards that are fairly rigorous compared to the rest of the country. Not Texas, which I'll mention. Or Jim Hightower is going to mention Texas in his editorial comment later. Go ahead.
My question is, following that line of logic, if the standards for the tests are as rigorous as any in the country, does the training that leads to this testing, does that also follow suit? Is that also rigorous? And I guess that would depend upon the area.
Well, logic would dictate that if the teachers aren't teaching at least to the test, and that's always a problem for me. I think teachers should teach in general substantive things, not just short-term memory stuff so the kids will do better on the test, but things that will affect them in the long. For example, if you don't imbue the students with a love of learning, like the meaning of the word imbue and how to pronounce it, then, you know, they won't keep reading.
Right.
They do well on the reading test short term, you know, in terms of speed and content, but they won't keep reading on their own initiative. And of course, that's one of those things. If you're going to be a good citizen in the U.S., you can't just listen to TV. That's never in-depth enough information. And even on the websites, you say, well, I can read text from the website. Even website stories are often very short and not balanced necessarily, especially with on the web. You get a lot of opinions just from one side or the other. And so reading is, as they used to say, fundamental. I thought that was a catchphrase. But the love of reading is really the fundamental thing, what you can get out of books. I mean, my mother, I think, instilled that in me by just taking me to the library every week from like 6 years old. We went to the library and she said, find some books you're interested in. You've got to find something. And so I would find, you know, it'd take me half an hour to an hour, and I'd go around the children's section or the adult section even, and I would find things that looked interesting and get at least one book. And my mother would always take out two or three. And although she did not have to have, she chose to be a homemaker, you know, in charge of the house. My dad worked at Chrysler Corporation. But, you know, by role model, there's mom sitting reading a book every day for at least an hour. And she read really fast, and she really remembered well. And she should have been able to go to college, but her parents wouldn't let her, wouldn't enroll her. In those days, the 1920s and 30s, girls didn't go to college.
Right.
Even though one of her teachers said, you should go to art school. You're very good at sketch art in high school. You should at least enroll in a like a Voc-Tech program to develop your drawing skills so you could do advertising, illustration, or whatever. And well, that's another story. But I'm just saying that the love of learning is what the teachers have to do primarily. And I don't know what the test is for that. There are ways to check this, you know, to see if after you do your lessons, do the kids do something related to reading or learning on their own in the school or after school or whatever. And there are ways to follow that. It's sneaky, but there are ways to find out. So I think, you know, all this testing stuff, it's very good. And the first thing is the standards for the obvious assessment of basic skills. But then it's really the behavioral changes that instill the love of learning, the love of reading, even the joy of doing math. That sounds weird to some people. But I only stayed in school because I discovered that joy early on, in spite of some teachers I had. I have to say that
right.
I'm going to learn in spite of this teacher. I love the subject. You know, I'm going to keep doing the reading. I'm going to do well in homework, even if it's a stupid assignment. I'm going to learn more than what the teacher, because it's so exciting to learn stuff about science and math and literature. So maybe not everybody will get that joy of learning, but the joy of reading or the importance of reading important things on a regular basis. So we don't know about that. But I good for the state, good for the curriculum to have the standards that high. Anything else you folks want?
Well, one, I wonder who the independent reviewers are.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of a broad term.
Right, but it means people not associated with state boards of ed. So it's educationalists. And when they say across the nation, that means it's not people in just one sort of category or the others, not just academics maybe, but you know, maybe consultants of some sort that are not associated.
I think that's really helpful.
What
you boards. Exactly?
Yeah,
you know, it's not like a Walmart greeter. I mean, this is somebody that's been in the field. This is somebody that uses math, maybe an engineer or whatever. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, anyway,
well, today's economy, the Walmart greeter might have a PhD.
Ooh,
so
good point. Yeah. Very good point.
They're usually seniors, though, that they don't pay anything to. But I think are the greeters paid?
I don't
something.
I don't know. My second interview was in it for a while.
Okay. Michigan Avenue work delay, just very briefly, last week you mentioned, had some comments about how business folks and even people just driving Michigan Avenue east and west for basic transportation to and from jobs, or while they're looking for jobs, you know, applying for jobs somewhere. That construction, which is on Michigan Avenue between Brady and Outer Drive in West Dearborn area, scheduled to start on March 29th, will be delayed until April 5th. They're still going to try to finish it all up by July 10th. Now, the segue here, I think, should be to a story that came up this Wednesday in the Press and Guide about some new businesses going to go up on Michigan Avenue, albeit a little bit west of Telegraph on Michigan Avenue. Maybe, Dennis, you want to sum that up quickly for us? What new businesses are we going to see?
Well, it's kind of in the planning. Well, it's beyond the planning, but it's not for sure. But Mr. Barry Murray, the director of Dearborn's Economic and Community Development Department, said, quote, "We hope it will become a Sonic." We've talked about this a little bit. Now, Amy, are you familiar with Sonic?
Yes.
Okay. Have you tried the?
I've been down south. I think in South Carolina or North Carolina, we stopped at a Sonic.
Well, Jay and I have not been.
Well, first of all, I'm sure people who watch TV have seen the ads, but it's a fast food establishment with relatively low prices, and they have some pretty funny TV ads.
Oh, they're so excellent.
They're kind of cool in that regard. And
but that's where I was headed with this, Jay, is that I saw the ads for, and I'm not exaggerating, it seemed like a solid 12 months or more before I knew of one even in the area. So they teased me. They, you know.
That's not fair.
Well, it's good marketing. I think they took it to an extreme because now I just don't even care, you know. but other people have gone, and of course, I have family from Oklahoma, and that's where this whole thing started. So I thought that was interesting. That Sonic's going to go where the Wendy's was. That's the plan.
Makes sense.
Okay. Wendy's didn't do well, and we talked about this earlier. There was a Showcase Cinema there, and when that closed, a lot of the stuff in the area didn't do as well. That brought a lot of people at the time. But now they're going to level this, is what I'm told. They're going to level the what used to be the Showcase Cinemas, put up the Sonic, and they're going to start to kind of reinvent that area.
Mm-hmm. Apparently the developer who built or owns the Hampton Inn on Michigan Avenue near Southfield Expressway, or closer to Southfield, is the one that's in charge of the property. Not the Sonic property necessarily, but at least the Showcase Cinema property. And there's still a question, what are they going to put there? Probably not another Hampton Inn. I think the chain of events there was that the Oldsmobile dealer, well, Oldsmobile did not become a continuing GM line even before the crisis, and so that dealership closed. And then, and I think the Cadillac franchise was bought by that other dealer in West Dearborn, and now they're running. It's the Lincoln Mercury dealer. Is it Krug or whatever? Now they have a Cadillac franchise there, so they moved the Cadillac franchise. I think they bought the franchise rights, you know, so there wouldn't be like two dealerships. They bought them from the previous owners, with Oldsmobile and Cadillac there, and then they built a Cadillac dealership next to the Lincoln Mercury dealership in Michigan, sort of the central part.
Isn't
of
that Westerborn. Is that Cadillac a Les Sanford? It is.
Oh, okay. The Les Sanford bought the franchise,
right.
And because they didn't have Cadillac there previously, but then that's what happened to it. So, but then when that went down, and then of course a lot of the businesses between Toys R Us and Chuck E. Cheese, whatever they were, I don't remember what they were offhand, they went dark. And so that shopping center really just has the end stores of Toys R Us and Chuck E. Cheese. And then when the cinema went down, obviously, I think to me, the automatic business or the easy business, the drop-in business from the movies closed Wendy's.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a difficult spot. It should be a good location, southwest corner of Michigan Avenue and Telegraph. And a lot of business going back and forth there.
But you do have to get off Telegraph to get there, and that's kind of a drag.
Right. And it's only easy if you're going east on Michigan Avenue to scoot right in there to that. You know,
absolutely,
if you're going
exactly.
east before you get to Telegraph. So they don't get the people who are living east of Telegraph, because you don't usually want to drive west. You just try to hit something on the way further east, I guess. But so it's be interesting to see if the Sonic works. It does have some cultural panache right now. We shouldn't go into, but I think it's ethically we must. How healthy is the food? Well, unfortunately, I don't know if they. I don't think they have any veggie burgers or salad bars where you can choose your own. But I think they do have salads. Mamie, do you remember salad on the menu?
No, we went for the desserts.
Oh,
and you can
they're
drive
known for
right
their
up.
Big shakes and desserts and that, right?
Yeah. And you can drive right up, so I don't think anybody's going to be,
This is a drive-in. This is a drive-in. This is roller skates and a whole thing,
you can
right?
probably sit inside, can't you? Or is it drive-in only?
I think it's drive-in only, isn't
really?
It?
Really? Sonic drive-in only?
I don't remember, but we drove in.
Okay.
Okay. And one other thing about the Hampton, from what I understand, the current Hampton Inn does not meet the new corporate guidelines, so that will not be run as a Hampton. So it is logical that they are going to do an actual Hampton Inn across. And I think there's a Red Roof Inn across the street, isn't there? On Michigan there? Red Roof on one side?
No. On a Telegraph.
Well, it's on Telegraph in Michigan.
So
this would be across from there.
Oh, right, yes.
And the Red Roof is pretty busy. So one other thing regarding movement. Remember the Chow restaurant on Monroe in Michigan that they had a fire about a year ago?
The Child?
Chow. Chow.
C-I-A-O. Yes.
Thank
Ciao.
You.
Ciao.
Ciao.
C-H-O-W. No.
Italiano. Ciao.
Well, guess where that's
which
moving.
Means either hello or goodbye, depending on your situation.
For all our Italian listeners.
Guess where that's moving, Jay? Your favorite place, Tenney Street.
Oh, really? Tennessee really? Roadhouse?
That's where they're talking about, okay. If I may. This is something, of course, I go right to it because I knew something Jay didn't, so I just went to this.
Absolutely. Gotta scoop me here.
The owners of Chow and Monroe say they're close to inking a deal that would allow the restaurant to reopen at a new location in West Downtown Dearborn. The popular Italian eater was badly damaged by a fire nearly a year ago, and it'll reopen at the old Tenney Street Roadhouse.
Yeah, I ate at the old location of Chow, which is a very small place. It was gourmet, fancy dining,
wonderful
people say. It was wonderful food. A little pricey, but it was wonderful food, and if they want to continue that, good luck to them. The Tenney Street Roadhouse, of course, had probably an equally large dining area because it was small in their previous location at the front, but in the back, they had that huge area, and it's probably still, unless it's been damaged, set up for live music performance.
Yeah,
so like probably Chow won't do the live music because they didn't do it before, and that's a whole different management issue. Got to have people, you know, scheduling artists and promoting them. And we love Tenney Street Roadhouse, WHFR, because of the blues artists and the fact that they allowed us to have benefits there at very little cost. That really helped us and also the Dearborn Public Schools. So I don't think Chow probably is going to have that commitment, but it means they're going to have to renovate that place radically.
Or use it for banquets. We need.
Well, they could, but yeah. I'd say it's like three times larger area behind the dining and bar area.
Oh, easily, yes.
Than in front that, you know, it's like banquet hall size, actually. So I don't know if Chow is going to move into that business or not, or just want to leave it vacant most of the time, because there's a large bar area for that banquet area, mm-hmm. too, It's classy. Obviously, we wish for live music and to support local artists. WHFR is one of our missions, is to support local artists, and we've got a lot of great local artists, too. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But, yeah, I'm glad to see that property owned by a certain someone is not going to be vacant any longer. And
right.
That seems fairly definite.
It seems Chow. That they're getting ready. But Chow is a surprise to you also. Because, like you said, the original restaurant was so much smaller than this area they're moving into.
Well, I mean, they deserve to have more room for more people to eat if it's the same sort of quality menu. It as I said, it's not a normal family priced food. It's a little bit more expensive than that. Probably, I think it was cheaper than Andiamo's, not to put them down because they're doing a nice benefit for us coming up.
When is that?
Okay, let's do that
Chow Chow.
That announcement here.
So Chow saying
WHFR 89.3 invites you, this station you are listening to right now, invites you to our 2010 Spring Jazz Benefit, Sunday, April 11th. In fact, it's our first Spring Jazz Benefit. This is going to be at Andiamo's on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn. Again, that's Sunday, April 11th, and it's a family-oriented thing from 4 to 8 p.m. So a Sunday buffet will be available, their regular buffet for $9.95 if you want to do that, or you can order from a menu in our banquet room there at Andiamo's. Admission donation tickets are only $5. You can get them at the door with all proceeds to benefit us. Our own non-commercial independent radio station right here in Dearborn. You're certainly invited to come hear the Marvin Jones Trio and the Eric Friebel Jazz Band. And there's a third band that's just been added, too, all performing at no cost to WHFR for your entertainment and fun. And so that's the 2010 WHFR Spring Jazz Benefit, part of the first day of our on-air pledge drive. Our radiothon to raise essential funds for us. We only do it once a year, April 17th to the 17th. 11th to the 17th is going to be the dates this year, coming up next month, just a couple weeks. And this will be a great time for all of you to get out and come together. And if you can't do the late night blues benefit on the 17th with us that we're going to do again at New Place Lounge, come on down, as they say, to Andiamo's with the whole family. And it's $5 a person. I don't know if we'll do discounts or whether kids or freebies. We'll work on that. Again, we need the essential funding to keep going here at WHFR to continue with the journal, in fact, as well as all of our music shows that we feature so uniquely and specially on this channel. So for more information, you can go to our website, whfr.fm. And supposedly there's a link there, but even information at hfcc.edu, our Henry Ford Community College website. Or just call us here at the station, 313-845-9676. I don't know if anyone's out front in the office to answer right now, and we can't answer because we're busy talking. But more information will coming up. But maybe you could sort of mark your calendars to be with us on Sunday, April 11th, 4 to 8 at Andiamo's, in this case. And maybe we'll be at Chow's sometime in the future in their big banquet room if that works out for them. Like to spread the WHFR bump around to success of local businesses. So, okay.
All right.
So back to the news here. A couple minutes, we'll do a couple of our Jim Hightower commentaries. And there is one about Texas education that you've just got to hear. In fact, he titles it the oxymoron of the phrase Texas education. In other words, the adjective doesn't fit the noun.
That's funny.
It's yeah, a little irony there. Okay. All right. So what else here on my exciting listings we have to talk about? I don't know if we have time right now. Let's talk about Mayor O'Reilly has gone on record, and I think it was part of his State of the State address too, but he's gone on record in at least the Dearborn Pressing Guide from last Sunday, the 21st, that he wants us to definitely vote yes on the November ballot proposal to setting up a commission to look at the state of Michigan Constitution and making changes, suggesting new ideas that weren't there before or that are different from what was there before. Now, we only get a chance to do this, folks, once every 16 years. That's in the Constitution we have now. And it was voted down the last couple times as a possibility to consider this. And so, by golly, Mayor O'Reilly thinks it's time. And why does he? And who's against it? All right. So I'd like to cover that with you right now. And this story is, close to the front of last Sunday's Pressing Guide. I found, in fact, that the Sunday Pressing Guide is more full of newsy stuff, at least for this show, and maybe your own thoughtful consideration than the Wednesday edition, but both are very good. And there's actually a very good story. Sean Delaney for the Press and Guide has put this together. Now, first of all, if it is approved this time in November, there's 2 years before the final resolution will come in. And in fact, we have to have an election, if this is approved, a general election, to elect about 150 people to this commission. It is partisan. Now, that raises for me the question is, can we only vote on Democrats and Republicans? What about the other political parties? Can they run delegates to it? Do they take the top 150, or do they come from each district? Two from each current district. I mean, I'm sure the Libertarian Party and the Green Party, and I don't know whatever other parties are still legitimate for, you know, a ballot status here in Michigan. There's usually a Socialist Labor Party of some name. To me, that would be the most fair, is to have all the parties that are ballot capable be able to run delegates and let people vote for whoever they want to for that. But because it's partisan, you know, the danger is, as I say in this article here, is that there will be wrangling just like we have now in the legislature in Michigan and even at the national level, at the U.S. Congress. You know, Democrats in favor, Republicans against. What we need, of course, is a sane and sober review, really by independents who know what they're talking about. So I think the partisan part of electing these delegates is unfortunate. But let's try it and see. That's all we can do. This is according to the present constitution that we have in Michigan, the charter for our state right now, that it has to be partisan election. But it won't be the same people that are representing us in Lansing right now. It'll be different people, but they'll be either chosen by the Democratic Party, Republican Party, or maybe some other parties to be in the election. That election has to be held no later than next May 2011, okay? Then these 148 delegates, okay, I said 150 about, 148 exactly, would have 2 years until October 4th, 2011 to finish their work. And then I think No, it would convene in Lansing no later than October 2011, and they had to finish their work by July 2012. Why? Because anything they recommend for change will be on the ballot for us to vote up or down as a package, not individually, but as a package, by November 2012. Right before December 2012, which is, of course, the end of the world. So we've got to get these things in place by December 2012.
I knew December, is that 21st?
It's a joke, folks.
I know.
It's a big December 21st, 2012, the Mayan prophecy, blah, blah, blah.
The way Jay tells it, what does it matter? We don't need to do anything.
No, I think we should do the best we can as long as we have the time. Until the end of the world, I'm going to keep doing my job as best I can.
That's a good attitude.
Okay, and I don't mean going out and partying. You know,
that's not your job. That's my job.
Like it's 1999.
Yeah.
Like the Prince song about let's party like it's 1999, and he released that a few years before, and everybody was...
Actually, quite a few years before, almost 20 years.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, really? 20 years of parties, and what did it bring?
I heard. Didn't you say that?
A big hangover in the year 2000, that's what it brought. That was a joke, folks. I did just get the movie from Netflix. I'm going to watch it tonight, the 2012 disaster movie, so I can...
Yeah, Friday
be up to date.
That would be an upper.
On the latest fictional information. You know, you don't want to miss out on fictional information in this world. popcorn priority, yeah.
As long as it stays fictional.
Since you mentioned movies, can I mention that I erred in saying the Manchurian Candidate. You were right.
We must correct our errors.
Frank Sinatra was in that, and it was Lawrence Harvey, not one of my favorites, Montgomery Clift.
Carry on. So, Frank, if you're looking down on us, no slight intended there.
That was so long ago. My gosh. Good for you for bringing that up.
This show, if we make a mistake, we admit it.
Is that called advancing a story?
I was trying to figure out how I could blame it on Dennis, but I couldn't see a way.
Here's one you could.
I love newspapers, but often their corrections are in small print, not on the front page.
No, on the second page. You're exactly right.
And then they don't tell you the full impact of what the original story was. They just say, Fred Jones is really Fred Jackson. Sorry.
There's a little bit of impact there.
So, but we're right here. We take real airtime equal to the other airtime, and we tell you... But we can't do all of those corrections on the air because there's so many. No.
Did you pick that one?
I think
it's the only one I've made in decades.
Correction. Okay, the opinions expressed on this show, correct or incorrect, are those only of us doing the show, not necessarily anyone else here at Henry Ford Community, faculty, staff, administrators, or students. However, we want to stimulate you to think about these issues. So even if we get them wrong, just like Amy looked up, probably internationalmoviedatabase.com.
No, I rented it on Netflix.
There you go. That's a way
to
do your research.
After that conversation.
Got to watch the whole movie over again. Do your research, and we're happy to just stimulate you to really find out the facts and then figure out, because what we say is not the whole picture. It can't be. We don't have time enough, even if we knew the whole picture, all the points of view. And in fact, I heard someone at a news conference this week that, in fact, Dennis was at it too. We heard from a speaker from WWJ.
Marie Osborne,
that's right. And she's been with them many years and a local news reporter and a news anchor for a long time. And she said, we always try to give the two points of view. And of course, I wanted to raise my hand and, you know, carp on that.
We only had an hour, though.
Right. And interrupt and say there's always more than two points of view. It's not just Democrat or Republican, liberal, conservative, you know, pro or con. There's many points of view. And in fact, I was going to say, where are the libertarians in that pro and con thing? Because they're often on the sides of so-called liberals, and also their philosophy, and they have a consistent philosophy, folks, is many times supporting Republicans or even more conservative than Republican Party. And so, libertarians will always be left out if you only do, like, liberal conservative.
Right.
And their points of view and their rationale is unique, as is the Green Party and other parties. There's many more points of view, even in terms of politics, than what the commercial media and even what we can feature. But we'll always try to go beyond Republican, Democrat, the two points of view here on this show, because that's what we're trying to do. Now, just briefly, and then we'll get to Jim Hightower right after this. What can the Constitutional Convention discuss? Well, everything. But specifically, what might come up again for review or might be suggested to happen new for the state of Michigan? Well, many things that the former wonderful newspaper man Frank Bewick and I have been talking about for years, like getting rid of term limits, like part-time legislature, like and so there's a list in this story, in the Press and Guide from last Sunday, of about a dozen or more things. Now, the negative side here, which is interestingly the Republican side, they don't want a constitutional convention because they're afraid that new liberal things might get introduced and then passed. Oh, my God. New liberal things might get introduced. Well, if it's the right thing to do and the people of the state of Michigan want it, you know, I can't believe the Republicans, who have an equal right to get their people elected in this partisan commission, wouldn't try to make their case and get more conservative things to happen. If you love the Henley Amendment, you'd want to make sure it stays. If you don't, well, so, hey, it's democracy, folks. If you've got your Tea Party behind you or whoever, get those people elected. But hopefully those electors will not be lockstep Republican-Democrat, but will be open-minded and do research from independent political scientists and others, analysts, that will get us on a better track. And I think once in 16 years, we need this review. Now, the Republicans say it might cost the state of Michigan $45 million because these people, 148 people, get elected, and the secretaries and the office space and the computer time and so on might cost as much as, although Democrats say, no, it's not going to cost that much. In fact, if you go to a part-time legislature, in 1 year you save $50 million. So that'll take care of the cost of the Constitutional Convention real quick. So because they did some straw polls of the average people, Democrats, Republicans in Michigan, say, do you want a Constitutional Convention to review issues that might need to be updated and changed? And a majority, Republicans and Democrats, say yes. But then they say, well, do you want to do it if it costs the state of Michigan $45 million? No.
That's kind of a tricky way to ask.
Yeah. I mean, everything costs something.
Right.
If it can save us money in the long run in Michigan by changing the way we tax and by and maybe even part-time, there are cost savings by changing things.
Right.
So that's just bogus to ask that question, because everybody today wants to be fiscally responsible,
right,
with their own budget, certainly, in their own situation. Oh, no, I don't want to force the state to have to put out $45 million more,
right,
that might go to education or my paycheck or, you know, reduce taxes. But, of course, we want these changes to be considered because the changes themselves, folks, might save us money, depending on what they are.
And you do. You have to pick and choose what you spend your money on, and this is obviously one in that column.
The cities, the states, and the counties are losing a ton of money various ways. Maybe we can talk about the whole charge of unfunded mandates, which are separate stories in the Press and Guide this week, and so well done, so well balanced, I think, and extensive. Not just a soundbite of two paragraphs, but they go on for a page or two, especially unfunded mandates, that the city will be better off. Why do you think the Mayor O'Reilly, speaking for the city, it's not his personal point of view, would be better off? Because they could change some things in the Constitution that would give the city more money to operate with here. And then we wouldn't have to have our taxes increased or be forced to do that to maintain certain services. So I'm just saying, Mayor O'Reilly, read his position, look at the possibilities. We should never be afraid of change, because we don't have to have it ultimately. Whatever they decide by 2012, we can vote down. All you voters out there, and I hope everybody's registered and want to vote, we can vote it back down if we don't like what these people have suggested. But there's a lot of things, quite clearly, to a lot of conservatives, I think, and as well as liberals, that could be changed for the better in the state of Michigan. I think I mentioned, and even Frank Bewick thought the idea was good too, unicameral legislature, not the two houses, not the balance of power going back and forth. And, you know, I think maybe for the U.S., the federal government, they need that. We don't want to move too quickly for stuff that affects the whole country, maybe. But in the states, we wouldn't need so many people elected. Costs of state government go well down. And And it's like, well, who's ever in power gets their way. No, you know, the Democrats are always scattered. They don't vote as a block because there's liberal and conservative and moderate Democrats. And so just because the Democrats might even have a majority, like right now in U.S. Congress, doesn't mean that they can really get anything passed unless they really make a heroic effort, which they did for health care this time. Health care reform, that's all it is. And maybe plus or minus now that it is finally a law, all the kickbacks, all the protests from Republicans, it's all done now, folks. You've seen the news, I guess. Of course, there'll be legal protests about this or that, you know, from the state of Michigan as well as other places about whether or not certain provisions are legal and should happen. But actually, most of the opinion people say those won't add up to anything, that we have reform and it will help an awful lot of people that don't get that help right now. And it won't affect people's coverage who already have coverage. And there might be a slight additional cost because of the way they decided to do this, which I wasn't in favor of. Universal single-payer health care. That's right. The public option. That would have brought costs down. But at this point, all the private insurance companies love this. They do. All of the medical and pharmacy, the drug companies love it. They all agreed to it. They're not getting cut out of the pie or hurt at all. Okay? So you might say, oh, the government is forcing. Yeah, but all the private companies that are involved in healthcare love it because even though they got to change certain ways to do business, they're not going to lose a penny on this, folks, which means we're not going to bring healthcare cost under control at all. And that's But a lot of reforms that needed to be done for everybody in the U.S., that's my opinion, are going to be good when people get a fair chance to look at all the details. And I have, but we don't have time to talk about that now. So let's go to Jim Hightower. We'll be back after two of his comments here, the oxymoron of Texas education, and who's watching our Wall Street bankers these days? You know, no reforms have happened. Okay. We want to talk also about today's Women's Recognition Luncheon. One of our WHFR staff members, Caroline, is just coming back to it, and she's got flowers in her hand. I just let her in the office. So
they let her in the office with flowers?
Yeah, well, they have table displays, and they give them to people, you know, on the way out.
Because Amy has allergies.
Uh-oh. Take the side door out, Amy. Here's Jim Hightower, first of all, with the oxymoron of Texas education. WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
I love nuts. Pecans, hazelnuts, almonds, pistachios, I love them all. But my favorite nuts by far are those homegrown natives on the Texas Board of Education. You just can't get any nuttier than this bunch. This little-known board is making our state a punchline for comedians everywhere because the majority of the panel's members are ultra-right-wing nutballs. How nutty? They're insisting that ideological indoctrination be paramount over education in the state's classrooms. The board's main power is to adopt curriculum standards for textbooks to be used from first grade through high school. And they've just put forth some whoppers in their unrelenting effort to plant their own ignorance in our history, government, economics, and sociology textbooks. For example, they shoved Dolores Huerta, the much-admired farm worker leader, from the list of people who exemplify good citizenship, dismissing this historic champion of justice as a socialist. On the other hand, the majority mandated that such right-wingers as Phyllis Schlafly, the Heritage Foundation, the Moral Majority, and Newt Gingrich's Contract with America be taught in history classes. Speaking of justice, nutty board members were so offended by this core American concept of fair treatment for all that they stripped it from a list that instructs grade schoolers on the characteristics of good citizenship. No doubt they'd also strike justice from our Pledge of Allegiance if they could. This is Jim Hightower saying, among others, getting their history book status diminished were such giants of American democracy as Thomas Jefferson and Martin Luther King Jr., while those getting a boost include Joe McCarthy and Jefferson Davis. Texas education wasn't that great before this radical insistence on right-wing correctness, but these doctrinaire morons are turning the phrase Texas education into an oxymoron.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Wall Street executives are howling that there's just no need for big bad government to tighten regulations over their financial dealings. We're not thieves, they huff. We're high-class professionals with auditors, boards of directors, and shareholders guiding us. We can regulate ourselves. Trust us. No. Let's look to Lehman Brothers for an object lesson in trusting Wall Street elites. When it collapsed into bankruptcy in 2008, the official word was that it was a victim of bad mortgages. Nothing amiss, just unfortunate. Now, however, a newly released bankruptcy report reveals that top executives at the investment house were desperately Enroning its books. Using an accounting flimflam, they spent nearly a year before Lehman's denouement manipulating its books to hide the rapidly deteriorating state of its financial condition. This creative accounting was done to deceive shareholders and Lehman's own board of directors. The CEO himself certified the misleading figures, and the report cites him for being, quote, at least grossly negligent. The bank's accounting firm, Ernst & Young, also knew of the manipulation, but raised no protest. So this is why well-tailored, high-class professionals must be regulated. In a pinch, they cheat. But regulation must be truly independent. For guess who also knew about Lehman's financial shell game even as it was happening? The Federal Reserve Bank of New York, headed at the time by our present Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner. He had dispatched officials to assess the bank's health, but they raised no alarm about the accounting gimmickry. This is Jim Hightower saying, Wall Street and the Fed have long been two peas in a cozy pod, with the so-called regulators treating the bankers as trusted colleagues. These giant banks deserve no public trust, but neither does the Fed.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Okay, late-breaking news here. We just found out about the winners of the Women's Recognition Awards here at Henry Ford Community College. It looks like, according to our staff member, Carolyn, who's just come from there, just concluded, folks, you can't go to it. They had a big luncheon to honor people in the community. First of all, the honor that was given to it's the Jean Brazil Community Role Model Award. Carol A. Goss is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Skillman Foundation, a private independent foundation whose mission is to improve the lives of children in Metro Detroit by strengthening their schools and neighborhoods. But with the main library at Oakland University in Rochester, where I did my undergraduate work, thank you very much, is called the Skillman Library. So that's the same foundation there.
That's cool.
So thank you for that library at the college level. But they're doing a lot right in Metro Detroit, strengthening schools and neighborhoods here. And she's been involved with them for 20 years. So we congratulate her on winning this award and all the great work she's been doing for education in the Metro Detroit area and the schools and neighborhoods through the Skillman Foundation. Carol A. Goss, congratulations on your award. And here, the Beverly Duquette Award of Excellence goes to Marcella Carlesimo, who is at Nolan School, we understand, is a secretary at the Nolan School, and congratulations. And apparently the on-campus, according to her things, the Henry Ford Community College on campus Women's Recognition Award goes to Catherine Wakefield, who's a nursing instructor here at HFCC. So congratulations to Catherine Wakefield for that recognition. Many people have received the Community Role Model Award in the past. In 2009, is Sharon Domage, who was on the Board of Ed for many years.
I know that name, sure.
Yeah, Alberta Muirhead in 2008, a community leader, formerly owned and operated with her husband Muirhead's Department Store, which is now a health facility in West Dearborn on Michigan Avenue. Governor Jennifer Granholm herself won it in 2007.
No kidding.
Yeah. And Carrie Guido, wife of our former and late Mayor Michael
Guido.
Okay, the family always pronounce it Guido, but His PR guys, if you're going to run for office, you got to have a strong name, not a weak Italian name like Guido. You'll never get elected with that. And, of course, Mike Guido is on the Board of Ed, so it didn't hurt him.
Right.
But, okay, so then Guido said, all right, I'll be, or Guido said, I'll be Guido from now on to win elections like a strong mayor. But how insulting for his advisor to say that, that Guido, which is a good Italian name and very traditional, is too weak to allow you to win an election. I mean, that guy, and I know his name, I won't mention him. I think he's still alive. I'm sorry. But, I mean, but he was, his advice has always been on target, whether it was racially motivated or not, or ethnically motivated or not. He helped a lot of mayors, and maybe even Mayor O'Reilly, his dad, might have used the same advisor to help him with his campaign strategies, as they call them. Politics is a strange business, folks. And obviously, the bottom line is, with all that advice, if you win, it was good advice. If you lost, it wasn't any good.
We're not hearing the advice from this particular person, from the losers. You know,
yeah,
we're not hearing what he told them.
I think he's still advising one of the judge candidates.
Well, we can ask the mayor if his dad
can. No. I don't want to bring up that guy's name. I didn't like him.
No. Okay.
Anyway.
All the opinions expressed.
Not necessarily.
Well, at least I didn't say his name directly. At least I didn't do that.
Tell me later.
But, I mean, he was a very successful political consultant because, hey, victories are a success. And so,
right.
Although how you do it is always another question or what's behind your thoughts. Okay. Anyway, so congratulations to the Focus on Women Recognition Awards and Dennis.
Well, Miss Wakefield will be on tomorrow with No Kids Allowed with Lynn. So I just want to bring that up. Also, speaking of a judge, I think you just did, this morning I wanted to congratulate at 10 a.m. this morning at the Bint Jabail Cultural Center on Miller Road, and I really hope I pronounced that properly. That's in Dearborn. Judge John Corbett O'Meara of the U.S. District Court, Eastern District of Michigan, administers the oath of allegiance to 300 individuals from dozens of nations. They became citizens this morning at 10 a.m., and we just want to congratulate them. I think that's wonderful.
Yep, absolutely. I'm going to jump to something that is on the front page of the Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday, and we're not going to go into the details of it, but someone has been coming in front of the Dearborn Heights City Council for several months and making his statements and making complaints, and in the last meeting, he's even suggested that the city should probe the actions that some of which he feels were against the city charter procedures in Dearborn Heights of the Dearborn Heights mayor, which is Dan Poletko. Okay. Now, it's interesting that, right, the subtitle, because people just read the titles, you know, probe of a Heights mayor urged. The council takes no action on this request. Okay. There was enough evidence presented by the city attorney and others to take no action, at least at this time anyway. And I just wanted to mention here, and you should read the whole story if you're living in Dearborn Heights. I talked to our Dearborn Heights staff member, Netta Pigging, about this and have some background, which we don't have time to share. One of the things that hurt this person's case was that he had asked the city for information, and he filed several official documents called the Freedom of Information Act documents, and it does require state, local, county governments to respond, although they can take years to respond if they want to, and they can redact the documents, which means they will give you documents that are the official record, Xeroxes of them, so that they answer your information request. But they can redact something if it's like state secrets, like U.S. government secrets. So, like, if you want information about UFOs from U.S. Air Force, for example, they'll give you the documents, and the page will be all black. Although what they started doing now, and Dave Twitchell, our UFO-informed person on the first Tuesday of every month in the forum show, he's seen these. The U.S. government now, rather than taking the time and using a black magic marker, they will just cover the area with a complete sheet of paper so it turns out white. So the whole page you get is not black because they magic marked out all the secrets. But the whole page is white because it's easier than using a marker on every line. It's just put another piece of paper there when you're Xeroxing it, and the whole nothing is there. But they responded to the Freedom of Information. Well, the lawyer for Dearborn Heights has told this person that was in this article last Sunday that he didn't get his information because he didn't respond to the exact documents. They can't just answer questions and write an email or send a letter. What they do by the Freedom of Information Act, and it's a good thing, reporters have used it a lot, is give you copies of the documents you want. You know, the actual letter of the law, if you will. And he never indicated what documents he wanted. And so that's why they didn't respond to him. And that's why maybe he didn't have all the evidence. And that's why maybe, partly, the Dearborn Heights City Council didn't take action on his complaints. Mayor Pletko, in the meeting, by the way, said, I'm not going to get into a public debate here.
Right.
You know, and but even though he had his presentation in advance presented to the president pro temp of the council, and the council graciously gave him more than 3 minutes to make his case because he had given all these documents in advance, some of the information that would have supported his case he didn't have because he didn't follow provisions right. And so this is in the
Times Herald.
The Times Herald, which, in fact, the page is called the Sunday Times, but in fact, it's their paper for the week, which, even though on this page it says it's the week of March 21 through 27th, on the front page it says it's the Wednesday edition, the 24th. So, whatever. The Times Herald, actually, on their editorial page, and I want to commend them for this, they do actually show you a sample Freedom of Information letter, which any citizen or reporter can use, the exact wording you might want to do, and exactly how to insert the document's name that you want. So in a way, this answers the man's question, well, how do I properly file an FOIA, Freedom of Information Act letter? And so it's right there, either for this gentleman or anyone.
That's any Kalamazoo Gazette, though, isn't it, that put that?
Well, the Kalamazoo Gazette put this whole editorial in along with the sample letter, but they're an allied paper to the Bewick publications, the Times Herald. Yeah.
And the Detroit News and Free Press Sunday edition had a lengthy story on Freedom of Information, the Freedom of Information Act, and brought up examples of how long different counties take to respond to Freedom of Information requests, Wayne County being the by far the slowest. Oakland County seemed to be above and beyond, you know, the quick and thorough requests. And let's see, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb. I don't remember Macomb, but, you know, it went thoroughly over what you can access, and it was a very thorough article. I thought it was very interesting, timely.
Thanks for mentioning that. We have about 5 minutes remaining on the new WH4 Journal for today, March 26, 2010. Just a couple of quick things. Wonderful story on the Dearborn Press and Guide, March 24th, page 12A. Dream comes true for John Dingell. You know, his dad introduced the first health care bill for all, actually, universal single payer, back in 1948 in Congress, and he has said it's always been his dream to try to get as close as possible or to fulfill his dad's dream for health care reform in the United States. And it's a sweet article about how he sees the new bill that he, of course, was a supporter of, even though it's not everything his dad asked for. You should read that. And we do commend him for his work and his dad for so many years trying to do what is really probably best for everybody in the U.S. one way or the other. Maybe the way it came about is not the best way, but at least the principle is there. Maybe not officially, that because I've actually heard other Republicans say, in fact, Ron Paul, who I love and admire for many reasons, that Ron Paul has stated just health care is not a right of everyone in the United States. It's true. It's not in the Constitution that way, folks, but I think it should be. If there's ever an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that we should get in there in the Bill of Rights to clarify this, is that the right to health care should be there for every individual in the U.S. That's my personal opinion. But John Dingell, it is sweet that in his long, long career, and yeah, he's going to run again, folks, this November for that same office, but he's in his 80s, you know, and he's very satisfied that that what has happened has happened. You can read about that, of course, and have your own opinions on health care, which differ radically from mine, perhaps, that we've expressed here. But good for him is that in his career that's happened. two big things that you should read for yourself. We do not have time to talk about unfunded mandates. This is when the state of Michigan and even the federal government, like No Child Left Behind, they pass laws that things have to be done their way, but they give no money to make it happen. And certainly local schools here in Dearborn and cities and counties, Dearborn and the county of Wayne, have been stuck with a number of unfunded mandates from the state of Michigan. Forget about the U.S. government for a while, but from the state of Michigan. And in fact, those people that love the Headley Amendment about schools and taxes not going up too much, Headley Amendment says the state of Michigan cannot do unfunded mandates. They've got to put the money there if it's going to cost these municipalities and these organizations anything, and they have not done that time and time again. And the legal procedures to right that wrong, even though it's state law that the state can't force things. Like, for example, maybe you're in favor of it, maybe not, I'm in favor of it, is the new tougher regulations for high school graduation in Michigan, high school graduation. So many different subjects of math and science have to be included and passed successfully before you can get to high school degree now, and that happened a couple years ago. But did they provide any money to hire the extra teachers or improve their curriculum, let's say in Dearborn for that? No, state of Michigan gave no extra money. In fact, they've been cutting money for schools in Michigan. But the mandate is there, and the schools have to follow it. So legal challenges have now started from Dearborn, from Wayne County, that this has got to change. Maybe we can put it in our new constitution that they can't do. But it's already state law. But even if you sue and win, the state doesn't have to follow what the courts say, which is amazing to me. And I've been just shocked when I've read these two very long articles together, page 7A and 10A, in last Sunday's Press and Guide, which you can probably find online.
Absolutely.
At pressandguide.com. And if you're a citizen here in Dearborn, you should read about that. And I think support the cause. Of course, how to get money for a state that's out of money is a very interesting problem. But maybe legislators shouldn't spend money that the state doesn't have, too, in the first place. Although I'm all in favor of the higher standards for high school graduation.
But didn't you say that this was a question of suing somebody, collecting is a whole other issue, right?
That's right.
What are you going to do, garnish the state's wages?
Well,
you know what I mean?
That's right.
You can't.
There's all kinds of reasons, no doubt, legal reasons, why the state can have these mandates, and you got to follow them or die or something. I don't know, as a school district or a city or a county, but you don't get any extra money, and you can't even sue and get the extra money. So what do you have to do? You have to raise taxes locally to make it happen?
Yeah.
You'd be almost mandated to raise taxes locally if the state won't give you the money.
What if you don't follow through on the mandate as the city?
Well, then they can take away any funding whatsoever. I mean,
right.
They can really kill you on that. They can probably, with schools like they did in Detroit, send in their own manager.
This may be a naive question, but the overflowing sewers that they're working on, was mandated by the federal government, correct?
The what?
The
combined sewer overflow project is a U.S. Department of Education mandate. And yeah, that was unfunded too. It had to happen locally. I don't think we're getting any money from that.
I don't think so either, and I think that's part of the issue, you know?
Or we might be getting partial funding, but I know it's costing the city of Dearborn $320 million to do it our way. There were other options, you know, to do it. And in fact, my water bill just went up hundreds of dollars in this last quarterly bill. It's probably most of it is sewer money, not water usage money. It's sewer money. And we knew this was going to happen, and we knew it. And maybe that's the reason. Although
maybe your toilet is stuck.
My daughter and granddaughter just moved in with me, and they wash a lot and use the dishwasher a lot, which I didn't do, so it's partly that. But no, it's sewer costs. It's
Jane is paper plates.
and that's really kicking in real big. It's almost as much as my heating and electricity bill from DTE now for water and sewage, which sewage is part of that $320+ million thing that the mere 100,000 taxpayers of Dearborn or 30,000 residences in Dearborn are having to start to pay.
All right.
And it's going to be a killer. And as I said in the past, I've heard Mayor Guido off the record say, you know, I'm going to be kicked out as mayor as soon as people see what my decision for sewer overflow project funding is going to really cost them. He didn't live